Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Really, 007.
Welcome to the Really 007 podcast, your go-to place for the silly and serious sides to James Bond. And tonight, I think we'll probably lean more to the latter, but you never know. Never know on these discussions. You can find us and listen in on iTunes and Spotify, and we're on all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Tonight, we are beginning another semi-regular series, which could go on indefinitely, this time on the books of Bond. So that's not just the Ian Fleming books and the novelizations, but books about Bond. And starting us off, we've got one of those. We're looking at He Disagreed with Something That Ate Him. And that title should immediately recount memories of License to Kill to Bond fans and Live and Let Die for the Bond book fans. But this book is by none other than Cary Edwards. It's a work analysing the two Timothy Dalton Bond films, The Living Daylights and License to Kill. I, Thomas Pickup, I'm joined by regular contributors John Kell, Math Pickup, and Rob Parker. Good evening, gents.
Good evening.
Good evening.
But we also welcome the most important guy tonight, the author of this fabulous work himself, Cary Edwards.
Evening. Thank you very much.
Good evening,
is it doctor?
Sir.
Good
evening. It is doctor.
But it should have been doctor, sorry, yeah.
Oh, I don't care. It's fine. I only sort of wear that when I'm feeling, you know, negative or something. I need a boost. It's like, I go turn around to my wife and say, you just got to call me Dr. Edwards today.
I'm sure it will be positive tonight, yes.
Oh, yeah.
My word.
Flipping
it. So, yes, you do have a PhD, don't you, in film, Cary, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, I did, yeah, from Lincoln University, although it's nothing to do with the Bond films. It's actually, I was looking at vigilante cinema of the 1970s. So, oof. Dirty Harry, Death Wish, Taxi Driver. I'm currently second drafting that ideas research from that into a book for an academic publisher. I probably shouldn't say whom because I don't want to jinx it. You know, I'm always terrified.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's a much bigger word. That's like a 90,000 academic sort of book that goes into libraries. And wow. People highlight two lines of and never read, but that's cool. I am indeed a doctor. Yeah.
So yeah, you probably know your stuff a bit more than us on the technical side. No offense to any of the others here. But I feel like we've all got a PhD in all things Timothy Dalton, so I think we're quite happy to talk tonight together. It's going to be a real loving, I think, of his Bond films. It's going to be a very positive episode. I know there's some are not less positive. Anyway, right, Cary. Yes, so you mentioned, of course, you've got this doctorate in film. In terms of your day-to-day job, are you an academic?
No, well, I'm sort of half and half. I actually teach in further education, so I'm classed as a lecturer, although sometimes I think that job title is compensation for getting paid less than teachers in schools. That's a whole political side issue.
Yeah, yeah.
So I teach film studies, I teach media studies, but I also teach some HE level stuff inside the college. But I also do bits of writing and that side of things as well, which is sort of, that, I guess, that academic level, if we want to call it that. So, for instance, I've got a chapter in a book on the new Hollywood coming out, which is out in October, which is with Bloomsbury Academic and that sort of stuff. But my day-to-day job, which is the best bit, is I get to talk about movies with people and analyze movies. Today, for instance, my last day with my second year students today, they've got their final exams, not the real exams because of COVID. So we were revising in Inception today because that's one of the movies on the exam. Maybe we should talk about Christopher Nolan later, but through bits of Inception.
Not a bad day job,
is it, really?
No,
really.
You could do a degree in that film alone, couldn't you?
I think it's time to go back to higher education.
Yeah.
My HNC in planning seems completely pointless.
It's got you here today, John. There was no formal interview process for this podcast. Yeah, so Carrie, your relationship with the Bond films. So I presume, like most of us, you grew up with them on ITV,
I think of them as VHS tapes, and I think of basically where I grew up on the street I grew up at the end, there was a Shell garage, which was also, because everywhere in the early 80s just had VHS tapes for rental. I mean, vans drove round with them in the back, and God knows what, it was bizarre when you think about it. And so I think it was really easy childcare to send me and my older brother with a couple of quid down, get some sweets, get a video. And there was several movies in constant rotation. Obviously, the Bond movies, I particularly think Octopussy for some reason.
Yes.
Was out a lot. Yeah. The Moors were around then more. So I sort of, when I was younger, the Moors. But I mean, the Indiana Jones movies were in rotation, the Star Wars movies, the Star Trek movies, and loads of stuff. So I just grew up watching movies. And then, of course, they were on like, TV and taping them off on TV. And it's something it was occurring to me because I was watching License to Kill and Living Daylights. And in my head, I still have the edited ITV versions where whole chunks of the movie are sort of missing.
Yeah.
And there's bits of still surprise me because I think there's scenes in Afghanistan that I never had on my videotape taped off TV. I forgot that happens. And pan and scan as well, because, you know, with the square TV screen, it's really bizarre. I somehow still get surprised that there's actually this stuff. There's that shot in License to Kill where they're all three of them in the car right at the beginning in Leiter's wedding car. You can see all three of them. And on the old ITV version, it starts with Sharky, or it starts with Bond and then pans across.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? Yeah.
And it's like, so it still kind of freaks me out, but that's good. That's a good thing. So, I just watched them.
They were squashed into that, the back of that limousine. They were. Quite tight, though, weren't they?
They were. And, I just watched them to death. as you did, and you wore the tapes out, and it was fantastic. And then the Dalton movies, I came to a bit late. I didn't really sort of notice it in sort of 87 when Living Daylights came out. I didn't go to the cinema to see that. And of course, when License to Kill came out, which was a 15, sadly, I was 10. So I got to those a bit later, a few years later, and I kind of got to them in the gap between 89 and 95, and just absolutely loved them. Just thought they were amazing and so fresh, because put next door to the Roger Moore movies, particularly those later Roger Moore movies, they're a real shot in the arm. And License to Kill is like from a different planet almost sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
In terms of growing up, you said, was Roger Moore probably your favourite actor as a child to play Bond?
I think, definitely when I was younger, because he was the one I saw the most. I got into Sean Connery a bit later, but I think the Moore ones, the ones that were in the video shop, so they're the ones we watched. I was thinking about this because they were big events on TV. It's ITV4, bless it, seems to have a Bond movie on. There's probably one on now. I have no idea. Yeah. It wouldn't surprise me. I think Octopussy was on last night. The Bond movies used to be massive events on TV. When Live and Let Die premiered on ITV, and I can't remember, it's 81 maybe, around then, it had the biggest audience for a movie on British TV ever.
Wow.
No way.
It was millions and millions of people, it's well over 10 million people. I'd have to look up the figures. So they were much more of an event than perhaps they are now on TV anyway.
I find that really, really interesting that Bond used to be a much bigger event. Do you know what hit me tonight while I was looking for, I've timed how long it takes the kids to eat tea. And I know that because I'm really trying to indoctrinate them in Bond. I work out how long my favourite sequences are in the films. It's about 8 minutes is like, if we keep them at the table for 8 minutes, we've done quite well. And you know, from the moment that the sub in License to Kill goes in the water, Dalton is holding the money going, you know, and he throws it in the back because he knows he's got loads of it, is about 8 minutes 50. I know we've got that in the tank, but I typed in on YouTube James 20 results came up and not one of them was Bond. And it feels like this is like a... And you had all sorts of other, you know...
That
like
generation.
Yeah, it feels like... And this is a whole nother question, but the sense that Bond was a massive, all-encompassing event isn't there anymore.
It's really interesting because my daughter's 17. I was going to say 16, but she was 17 last weekend. I've just got one child, which is enough, frankly. She's lovely. That sounds awful, but she's wonderful. But you know,
she could see License to Kill at the cinema.
But,
though,
which, yeah, absolutely. But she has absolutely no interest in Bond films. Dreadful. It's just, I don't know what I did. And she's interested in movies, and she's actually doing a course at the college, not one I teach. And she's interested in special effects, and she goes away and creates things on her computer, which I have no understanding of. And it's just like, oh, I can't get to watch a Bond film, though. So I don't know what I've done wrong.
Not done anything wrong, mate. It's where Eon and MGM have gone wrong.
Oh, here we go.
Right. I'm just going to bring a slight bit of balance, but my wife driving to work today, she works in a school, and her main job is looking after a different child in a class, whoever needs the help and the support. And she said to me, I got stuck with this really annoying boy the other day who brought every single conversation back to James Bond. It was like being at home. And
get out of the house to get away from Bond.
Exactly. But she was saying, like, he tries to talk about, bring every conversation about Bond to everybody, and nobody's interested whatsoever.
Oh, no.
So he is like a complete loner in that field. So there's one of them out there, and whoever you are, we're cheering you on, son.
God bless him.
I
do wonder whether they've been overexposed, and that's actually devalued them. I was thinking about this the other day, because Disney, I don't want to talk much about Disney, but they protect their rights of their movies very... They do not let them out on TV very often.
No.
Their DVD prices have never fallen. They have kept it, and they've kept a certain level of value to their product, which is really interesting, whereas the Bond films have been so exposed, so repeatedly shown. Yeah, but you kind of almost can ignore them.
You've never been able to get them on a streaming service for free, I don't think, though.
No.
No,
that's bizarre. That is really bizarre.
It is interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
But maybe Amazon soon, from what I'm reading in the
press.
Yeah,
maybe. There's always that.
I think it's quite good to always know that they're going to be on ITV every year, at least, or something like that. If you were told that, say, a streaming service had exclusive rights... Nearly went to Elliot Carver. If you were told that you couldn't sort of just record one off normal telly, it might be a bit weird, that, mightn't it?
It would be. Yeah, there's a balance somewhere in there. I don't know what it is.
We shouldn't have to pay for our bonds.
Like Test Match Cricket.
I love, like, you saying that, like, you don't have them all on at least DVD. Possibly several copies.
Well, I haven't actually got around to the Blu-ray. I know Rob has.
Oh, what?
I think John has as well. No, still gone.
I have.
So when I watch them, I'm still recording them off TV because it's the Blu-ray quality, isn't it? Because it's better quality than the DVD. But then, of course, License to Kill, you might not see all the horrific scenes. No. They might be cut. Yeah. So.
Absolutely.
All the alleged good stuff. The only problem, which is why I'd love them to come on a streaming service, is that the little lad who's 3 now, when he wants to watch a James Bond, he just gets all the discs out and throws them around like coasters.
Oh, hey.
And it's like, stop! No!
Yeah.
And then there's lots of me muttering on the floor going, he's got no sense of respect.
Yeah. Is it like when, you know, on Alan Partridge, when Lynn spills Sunny Delight all over Bond tapes?
I walked into the living room yesterday and found 5 discs, Dr. No, Live and Let Die, Diamonds Are Forever, and World Is Not Enough, on the floor, just on the carpet, and my initial reaction was, no!
Warrington's maddest man.
Good mix, those few.
Yeah, no, not bad. Not bad.
Kerry, we know, obviously, done a book on Timothy Dalton, but would you say he's probably now your favourite Bond?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I did flick through the book before checking to you guys, because I've not read it back for ages, and I did. And I think I'm a bit too negative on the Roger Moore's. An early comment, actually, I think Roger Moore's brilliant, but they're different. I think all the Bonds have really positive qualities. Sometimes the films don't actually match up to the quality of the actor, perhaps. But I think Dalton is brilliant. I think he made two good ones, so he's never had that moment where he made a bad one or a disappointing one, which is, you know, I kind of, would it be nice to get a third one? Yeah, probably, but what if it was rubbish? So we're saved that. So he's never made a bad one. It's just his intensity. It's really interesting because I was watching it thinking, I completely believe in him that he would kill people. I believe in all his decisions, but I also believe that he can be softer and a kinder guy. And something I wish I'd done more of in the book is really talk about the romance in Living Daylights. That's a really romantic film.
Yeah.
And it's a very soft romantic film. I do touch on it a bit, but I think I could have pushed that further because you really see him try and romance a woman. It's not, you know, just about sex. It feels more like falling in love. And that's a really, really beautiful part of the movie.
It's amazing. There is so much to explore. Just two films. The amount of themes that come up, and we obviously will go into those in detail. Nauseating detail, the same joke every week. If you had to name one favourite, could you, Carrie?
I usually think it's License to Kill. But again, I watched them back to back, and I was thinking, but it's a whisper. Oh,
it's one of these, though.
I do just about prefer License to Kill. But they're quite different, so the qualities are different. Dalton's brilliant in both of them, and it feels like the same Bond across both movies, and you see him develop and grow in different ways, which I think is really interesting. What I like about License to Kill is they take Bond right out of his comfort zone and throw him into a situation where he's almost not quite deranged, that's possibly too much, but the vengeance, the personal vendetta theme, he goes off track and it really does something interesting with the character, which after 27 years since Dr. No was a really exciting thing to do. Whereas Living Daylights, as much as I love it, and I do love it, is a genericish Bond film with Dalton in it, and it wasn't written for him.
Yeah,
it was written with nobody particularly in mind. But he fits in it, and it, you know, obviously it's tailored and twisted to him. But License to Kill is the proper thing. That's a proper 100% Dalton James Bond film. Yeah.
So excited!
I'm excited to watch it again.
As soon as this is over.
Dear me! Just to watch him going, you know, the slow motion run with the guns. You know,
oh yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So excited.
Sorry, we're going to have to stop this, lads. We're just going to watch License to Kill.
Just take a break.
Watch along. This episode could just devolve to a watch along, could they?
I think you watched it after we spoke to Anthony Starr, Rob, didn't you? As soon as it was finished.
I watched it. I watched it the night before speaking to him, then the night we did.
I that was a bloody great interview. I'm glad you said Anthony Starr because I just want to call him Truman Lodge because I cannot remember. Truman Lodge. One of the things is in my mind to talk to you guys about was the physical presence of Dalton, because it's really interesting because Anthony Starr talked about Dalton's fitness regime, which pretty much was cigarettes and women. And not many women.
Oh, right, sorry. Martial arts. Yeah.
And I was just thinking about how the body's evolved, and you know, Daniel Craig is huge and muscular. And I kind of don't think that works for Bond. I think Bond should be a fit, healthy guy. And Dalton's what, he's 6'2". He looks good. When he's hanging off things, when he's on the top of the Land Rover, I believe he's on the top of the Land Rover. I mean, he was on the top of the Land Rover, but I believe it as well. If you read the Fleming's novels, Bond basically smokes, drinks, and eats creamy food and occasionally goes for a swim. And I just don't see him as a guy who'd be in the gym sort of eating, I don't know, blended chicken breasts at 3 a.m. or whatever Daniel Craig eats.
Not at all. Like, there's like an extensive period in the Thunderball novel where Bond is lamenting the diet that M's got him on, you know, because he's like talking to the dinner lady, isn't it? How upset he is with the food he's been made to eat. I box carry, not to any level or anything like that, but the thing in the gym that we always talk about is muscles don't mean anything. You know, it's up here that counts, that kind of thing. So whenever anyone comes in and shows off the big defined muscles and all that kind of thing, we fight over each other who can go get in the ring with him, because you find them out really, really quickly. And that's the same kind of thing. I think that Dalton had it up there. Like, he's won the fight up here, you know, before you step in with him.
If you think about the actors who played Bond before Craig, I mean, I'm not saying everyone was saying it, but there's sort of the clickbaity, oh, finally we've got a Bond who you actually think could kill someone. But I mean, that's utter rubbish, isn't it? Have you seen Connery? He was Mr. Universe. He's like 6'3", massive guy. Then Lazenby, pretty big guy, pretty handy in a fight. Even Roger Moore, I know people laugh, but again, 6'2", 6'3", pretty handy.
Roger Moore, we laugh, but he was in good shape. I mean, maybe not the later movies, but you know, he's never really overweight. He's in good shape.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I hope Pierce. I look like that at 58.
Yeah.
Bite your hand off.
I mean, I was watching For Your Eyes Only last night, and especially in the scene where the they get thrown into the water and the yacht and obviously they're tied up. I mean, he's in fantastic shape.
He is really
toned. I mean, he does not look out of place next to Melina Havelock by any shape.
No, that's fair. Absolutely fair.
And he's like 54 or something like that.
Yeah.
It's incredible. In terms of Dalton getting the role, he'd had quite a few missed opportunities, a bit like Pierce Brosnan. It sort of dovetailed a bit. Mm. I think the Broccolis, particularly Dana, always wanted him as Bond, even when he was in his 20s. And he came in to audition, didn't he, I think? And he said, no, I'm too young. So, which again, I think with Pierce, we got them both at the right time. So I think it worked out quite well. Roger Moore had said a few times, hadn't he, like, this is going to be my last one. And I think he said it basically for the last three, didn't he?
Absolutely.
But then he was sort of coached back to it.
And we had screen tester people. It's, what's his name, Brolin? James Brolin.
Yeah.
His screen tests are really interesting. He was very close. But, you know, Roger Moore was, I mean, he was doing it as long as they were going to give him a bit more money.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So, and I'm glad he did because, you know, they are all worth watching. And I think when I was younger, I didn't value them so much, but there is something really accessible about the Roger Moore movies that anybody can watch them. And yeah, they're fun and silly, but that was cool. That's cool. You know, Bond movies, what's wrong with a Bond movie working for a 7-year-old as much as anybody else? You know?
Yeah.
Well, they used to be billed, as you pointed out in the book, they used to be billed as family adventure, action adventure movies, didn't they? Mm, you know, and that was like, certainly ages 5, 6, 7 was when I really fell in love with it. With Moore. Truthfully, with more.
Mm. Yeah. Are you, Kerry, do you think, are you under the impressions maybe that, I don't know, A View to a Kill would have worked just as well with Timothy Dalton? Do you
think? I think it would have taken some rewriting, but I think Dalton across against Walken and Grace Jones would have been interesting.
I don't
think he would have worked with Stacey. Stacey's a very different... No. Woman to the women in Dalton's movies.
Mm.
There would have perhaps been slightly less back projection in some of the action scenes, though.
Which, oh, my God! Oh, no, that's not even more, is it?
Yeah. No, but it is the scene that comes to mind, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
The firefighting chase as well, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so, you know, but again, I'm pleased we got a last
more
one. It's a swan song for him. And I think he knows he's too old in that movie.
Yeah.
It's really interesting that he's enjoying it. And I always love, nobody remarks on it, but the really mucky Sid James laugh at the end of the movie when he's in the shower cracks me up every time in that movie.
I can't remember it because at that point I'm ushering my children out of the room as quick as possible.
And then turn the volume up.
What does he do? Yeah,
She says, so he's in the shower with Stacey and they're doing, I'm going to put a little bit of soap here and there and all this stupid thing. And Q's massive robot dog.
Which is Johnny robot. Five into
like the worst spy device ever created. Wheels in. And yeah, she does the old James bit. And you just hear him going, it's sort of mucky.
Really?
Yeah, you do, really. And it's like, oh, brilliant. Bless
literally
you.
His last laugh.
Yeah.
And then he finishes with ooh.
Yes. I love Roger Moore's noises. And I don't, on Twitter, I can't remember who does it, but has done a super, keeps doing all the times he says, well.
Yeah.
Robbie Sims is it, yeah.
Yeah. It's absolutely so good, fantastic. Yeah.
He has a well Wednesday, doesn't he?
Yeah. cheers me up every week.
Yeah, it really does.
One of the other guys we interviewed, Andreas Wisniewski, Necros, of course, he said that he was under the impression that Ian McShane was going to be Bond when he signed on, because they didn't really know. So it shows how late in the day Pierce obviously was dropped
I mean, Pierce was there. He was basically the day before. He had I think it was a 60-day contract extension for Remington Steel. And on day 59, he got a phone call saying, we're renewing the contract. Phoned Broccoli, and Broccoli says, then you're not doing James Bond, which, must have been heartbreaking.
Oh, dear. Yeah,
I mean, this
and then
guy,
it was cancelled anyway, wasn't it? Or
yeah, he did a couple really of TV anymore. Movies and they cancelled it, so it was a complete waste of his time. I actually think Brosnan benefited from being a bit older. I think he looks better by the time of GoldenEye. Dalton, like you said, had been around, so he'd been around in the 60s. I think around Her Majesty's Secret Service, he was in the mix.
Yeah.
And then you know, with Roger Moore negotiations, he was a name who was in circulation. But he wasn't that much in contention for Living Daylights because he was busy. He was doing this TV movie, Brenda Starr, which I've never seen, but apparently it's terrible.
No one's seen it, no.
Yeah, probably because it's absolutely terrible. But because things were so delayed getting Living Daylights, suddenly he was free perfectly at the time. But they started filming in Gibraltar with stunt dub. So they had to get Dalton's haircut and stuff because his hair was wrong. And he was actually announced to the press when they were filming in Vienna during production. So it was sort of completely the wrong way up. It's a really interesting press conference that he comes across as, well, exactly as you'd imagine Timothy Dalton, quite intense, very serious and very private.
Yeah.
Oh, I just love the man so much.
It's the absolute
It's pretty overwhelming for someone who is an actor as opposed to a movie star, isn't he?
Yeah.
You know, he's a proper thespian, and just to be flung into that, you know, because normally they'd have like months and months of preparation, and now they'd be like coaching you how to deal with the media, wouldn't they? They would. They'd have like your own media people and how to answer interviews and preparation for the role, because he obviously loves to prepare for the role, so he didn't have much time to do that either.
No, I mean, fortunately, he liked the movies, and particularly the early ones, and I think he usually talks about Dr. No and From Russia Love. It's interesting, because Brosnan always talks about Goldfinger. He has that one speech where he talks about going to the cinema in Goldfinger in 64. But Dalton talks about Dr. No and From Russia with Love, and then he talks just... His research is he just went and read the books.
Yeah.
That was his research.
Yeah.
And I think that shows all the way through his portrayal.
Thankfully, got the role. I didn't know this, actually, until I was researching for this episode, but I think it might have been about at the time or just after this had come out, but Sean Connery actually endorsed Dalton as Bond in an interview. Because he very rarely gives interviews, Sean Connery, certainly about Bond. He's, you know, like, can we just stop talking about James Bond? This is my past. But he did, yeah. So that's pretty impressive as well.
Oh, it's good. It's interesting because it's really good talking to you guys and talking, just seeing more widely how Dalton has been more embraced as time has gone on. It's a really interesting thing, this.
Yeah.
Is that actually, if you go back and look at the reviews for Living Daylights, people did like him. Bit of an air because License to Kill didn't do as well as it probably should have done. I'm sure we'll talk about that. And then you have the production gap, that there's something wrong with Dalton's Bond, but there wasn't. There was something wrong with MGM's financial situation, which has been true since about 1980, if not earlier than that. And there's still problems with MGM's financial situation. And the fact that he didn't do another one, he turned GoldenEye down. Now, it depends who you read. He either turned GoldenEye down or the studio pressured the Broccolis about that. But the Broccolis wanted him back. You know, they've always been very clear that they wanted him back in GoldenEye.
Wow.
And they wanted him back for, like, was it, again, a multi-picture deal, you hear? So
which
that's
why
maybe
he
turned it down.
Yeah.
Because you just wanted to do one or two.
Absolutely. He didn't want to sign up to that. Because, and you said this, he's not a film star. Dalton. I mean, that's not to say he isn't a star in his films, but he's an actor who does movies and TV and stage work. He likes his privacy as an intensely private human being. And suddenly being recognised in every street corner in the world, I mean, that must be mind-boggling. It opens up a lot of doors for you, but it closes a lot of doors as well. And I always think, in an odd way, they cast kind of the wrong guy with Dalton, because he is a great actor. He isn't a film star. He's usually the guy they would cast as a villain. You know, particularly in Hollywood. And if you think The Rocketeer, he's a brilliant villain in The Rocketeer.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's got such good range, hasn't he? And he probably enjoys that variety. And so doing two Bonds has suited him in a way. I mean, we could go on about the 91 and 93 never made Dalton's Och. But it... Oh, my word. It's so interesting, wouldn't it? Where, you know, an amalgamism of the two, maybe.
Yeah, something in between the two. It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it doesn't.
So exciting.
I was completely unaware that the Broccolis wanted him to continue in GoldenEye. I just did not know that at all.
Yeah, that's what they said. That's the official line. But there was definitely pressure from sort of the heads at United Artists, MGM, John Kelly, and people like that, is that they wanted somebody they knew, they wanted to relaunch it. You know, Pierce Brosnan was the obvious choice. A lot of names are thrown about, a huge amount of names, from Ralph Fiennes, Mel Gibson, Hugh Grant, Liam Neeson. They were all thrown about.
As with a lot of things, I can see both sides of this, because you know, for both of them, there'd been such a big gap. License to Kill, you know, as you talk about in the book, Kerry, like, it hadn't done as well, you know, sort of respectively as probably they'd hoped. You've got this long gap. It does sort of seem perfect for a sort of big relaunch, you know, freshen everything up. Obviously, I absolutely love Dalton and I wish he'd done more, but I think it would have been the 91 and 93 or just one film there.
Yeah.
Rather than after that big gap, it makes sense to go with someone new, and also, you know, slight change of direction. Pierce Brosnan is more of a movie star than Timothy Dalton. But then, yeah, from Timothy Dalton's point of view, you can see that, yeah, you know, he is an actor, an actor's actor. He's not the same in every film or a version of himself in every film. He's a quality actor. And for him to have then had that big gap and then signed himself up for two or three more, however long, it's sort of, you know, big decision for him.
It's a big commitment. It means you're not doing your stage shows. You're not doing the interesting work. You're just going to be James Bond and you fit work in. And let's be fair, GoldenEye works brilliantly. And Brosnan
Absolutely.
That's what I mean. I don't know if you guys agree, but I think it's his best Bond film. I think it's his best Bond performance. I think he knocks it out of the park. I do sometimes wonder whether GoldenEye's so good, though, because when the initial scriptwriter for it, Michael France, was on board, he was imagining Timothy Dalton. And a lot of the physicality of GoldenEye and the emotional intensity of GoldenEye, you know, the conversation about martinis drowning out victims and...
You talk about that in the book, actually, Karen.
I do.
Really interesting.
I do wonder how much that's, you know, Michael France thinking about Dalton. Sadly, I don't have hold of all the drafts of the script because it went through God knows how many drafts, but it's an interesting thought.
I mean, 6-year gap now would be like standard, wouldn't it? Yeah, well, Daniel Craig having a holiday, wouldn't it?
A Bond film every 2 years in the 80s.
Thank you, John Glenn.
Do you know what we were talking about before about how that Bond isn't it's not in the top 20 things when you type in James on YouTube.
Yeah.
Is because of the gaps, the insistent gaps between films.
If it was taken over by someone like Disney, I'm pretty sure they would rectify that.
Well, I think if Amazon do buy MGM, you know, or whatever the company's called now, I can imagine that the money potential's huge. So, yeah.
This is all Leon have got to do, isn't it? They like produce a couple of other films, well, like the rhythm section and it's random films like this.
It's a difficult one because there's been so many behind-the-scenes problems and the financing situation. I mean, No Time to Die is apparently costing $1 million a week in interest payments. Because of the financing.
Yeah,
seriously.
So
delaying that, this is not something they clearly wanted to do. At some point, and some bit of my brain says, how difficult is it to make a Bond film? And then a bit of my brain says, actually, it's probably really difficult.
But in the 80s, they had the same people involved with every stage of it, didn't they? The whole cast and crew and behind the crew were already waiting, weren't they? They were just getting on
with it. They were straight on the next one. So Richard Maybaum and...
Yeah, it's a full-time job.
Michael Wilson were straight on the next script. Get that one in the can. What's our idea for the next move?
And I think as well... Excluding License to Kill, they're relatively formulaic as well, aren't they?
Follow
a pattern. And actually, I'm all for that. I'm not someone who... I'm quite happy for that to continue now. I think half the problem for me now is that they haven't done that and they've tried to be a bit too clever. Mm. And that's kind of gone down a rabbit hole. But yeah, I mean, I was watching a YouTuber the other day and he said, with regards to this Amazon bio, he says, all he wants... is a Bond every 2 or 3 years and a video game in between. That's all he wants, you know. And I think, actually, I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
I don't want a big universe. I don't want big spin-offs of Money Penny series. And
Unless it's Lois Mack.
A Bond film every couple of years with a video game in between. Yeah. And I'm a happy boy. You know,
and that keeps it in everyone's minds, like Rob says. You know, it would come up in your searches. The kids would be far more likely to remember them.
But also having a family appeal. I mean, there's nothing. I wouldn't make my kids sit
PG-13.
The last few films. There's just no way.
I know a lot of people make this comparison, and it's a problematic comparison in some ways. But you look at how the Mission Impossible movies are being knocked out every couple of years, and they're very high quality entertainment. I'd rather have a Bond movie because they don't have the finesse and the sort of. The class and charm of a Bond movie, but they are knocking out some really good entertainment, some incredible action scenes, and they are doing it. You know, they're filming the new one right now. They've been up in Yorkshire, haven't they? I think filming the new one, and that's amazing that they are turning those around. But I think Tom Cruise is probably a force of nature and is doing that himself.
And I think
so hardworking.
I don't want it to turn into Daniel Craig bashing or something, but Tom Cruise is so at the forefront of everything that is Mission Impossible, and because he's so determined and, like you say, relentless. He's driving it forward. And when you've got a star at the centre of it doing that, I mean, that you know, that's going to help. Where obviously, you know, Daniel Craig's been quite reluctant to keep doing them. And especially, you know, I'm sure it was, you know, a physical, you know, it takes its toll on you. So, you know, and Daniel Craig does a lot of his own stunts. So
you're playing James Bond.
No, I know.
Shut the hell up, man.
I'm playing devil's advocate, but I'm just saying the sort of comparison is that you've got a star who isn't as keen to keep going and put films out, and therefore, well, you know, that's part of the difference. But I think with Bonds at the moment, the tail is wagging the dog, not just with Daniel Craig, but also, you know, like I said this to the lads, I think recently this week, like when they get a director like Sam Mendes, then he calls the shots and he wants to make it a Sam Mendes film. You know, previously when you had like John Glenn, even Martin Campbell, I would say, it's not a Martin Campbell film or a John Glenn film. It's a James Bond film. And, you know, the engine keeps running and we keep
I completely going. Agree with that. And it's, Martin Campbell's actually a really good example because, you know, he's made some other good movies that, you know, The Mask of Zorro, for instance, is terrific. But he didn't come from this sort of Oscar-winning auteur background. He's a solid action director. And everything's about the movie. But I think it's set in the Brosnan years because, you know, you had Campbell... Roger Spottiswood comes from an editing background, kind of a, we're not mentioned Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, but, you know, he was a solid action director. And then they brought in Michael Apted, and I always thought that was a weird decision because Michael Apted, you know, not a great director, Gorillas in the Mist, but a documentary maker. And then it's an odd decision, and I think that's partly because, you know, the stars sometimes they want to do more interesting work, and it's just, but it's a Bond movie, entertain people.
But they still have that core group of people, the second unit, the editors and everyone who were there at the time. I think, to be fair to Daniel Craig, it shouldn't be on him to sort of be driving this franchise.
Absolutely.
It's the producers who need to be a bit more upwardly mobile and just sort of get on with it. And like you say, they've not that many other films that they've got to be releasing. Like you keep saying, it might have to get worse before it gets better. We've no idea what's going to happen. No Time to Die, because it's got too many pies to, it's got too many, what do you call it, plays to spin, hasn't it? In terms of the plots and all that.
I think we've got to this point where this keeps coming up because we're all concerned about where the franchise goes from here.
I hope No Time to Die knocks it out of the park. And it's
of course.
You know, I'd like some more fun as well. I think, you know, it's interesting, License to Kill. So License to Kill is a serious movie, but actually there's quite a lot of fun in it.
Yeah.
You know, whereas some, you know, Skyfall and Spectre I find just a bit dour, a bit, you know, depressing.
Yeah. I might be just the knowing humour, isn't it?
Yeah. I might be jumping the gun a bit here, but I think it just ties in with what you were saying. Because I always think about License to Kill, I think, well, it's so far removed. Why do I love it so much and why do I struggle with Spectre? Because they're both personal focus of Bond, personal motive. But what I think it comes down to is that there's that bit in License to Kill where he's gone rogue and then Pam Bouvier tells him about the deal that she has with the Stinger missiles with Hela. And at that moment, he realizes that he has cocked it up with his own personal views. There is actually a bigger mission that there is to do. And the problem with the Craig era is that there never is a bigger mission.
Yeah.
It's always about James Bond.
It's always you, James.
Yeah. The brother thing.
Or Judy Dench.
Also, License to Kill isn't stupid, because I find Spectre really stupid. I'm just going to put that out there.
Fine. You're a doctor. You can say what you want.
Absolutely. I'm allowed. You know, like, I haven't watched Spectre that much, and I'll be fair, even the Bond films I don't like, over time I tend to warm up to them, and I haven't. I haven't watched it particularly often because I actually find it quite dull, which I think is the worst thing about it.
I find
it actually really slow paced. And Sam Mendes, apparently they were editing practically in the day of the premiere. They hadn't really finished editing that movie, which is an odd thing. But the thing about, it's interesting, Dalton's Bond is fallible and he makes mistakes. And absolutely, he cocks up, you know, Pam's deals for the Stingers. He is blinded by vengeance. He does need to actually start working with Pam and Q to get things done. But it's a believable journey because he's been given a really proper motive. And something I mentioned in the book is that I see Della's death standing in for Tracy's death. Tracy's death was never properly addressed because Lazenby didn't come back to Diamonds Are Forever. You have that moment at the beginning of Diamonds Forever where Connery is just globetrotting and abusing Japanese people and strangling women on the beach. And just that bit that's always cut out on TV with the bikini. And then you get that moment where he kind of kills Blofeld, but of course doesn't. And then, that's it. And we mention it, but it has power because when we mention it in Spy Love Me, it's a powerful moment when Anya mentions it. And when it comes up at the start of Fewer Eyes Only with the gravestone, it adds depth.
Yeah.
And so I think there's resonance there because it's not a closed thing. So he comes home and sees something very similar. Well, he comes back to Leiter's house and he sees something really similar to what happened to him.
Yeah.
And absolutely, he's channeling his feelings for Tracy, I think, into that mission for revenge. And that's why it has a lot of emotional resonance. It's part of the problems I have with the reboot idea with Craig. And Casino Royale, by the way, I think is fantastic. I think it's a superb movie. But you lose all the things about Tracy. You lose all that stuff. And I think it's really sad that those echoes and ideas get lost there. But in a sense, License to Kill does offer a sort of sense of closure to that narrative too.
I think the strength of Tracy's legacy hinges on the fact that in the films since after her death, the moments where she's brought up, the performances by the Bond actors in question have been so good.
Yeah.
I think Tracy's gravesite in For Your Eyes Only, Moore is outstanding. Like, there's a detached stoicism, like he's depositing a piece of his past there, which I absolutely love.
They don't dwell on it though. It's just
and that's
good acting.
Far more effective.
Yeah,
the fact that there's no dwelling, like this is a part of this man's past.
Yeah,
and that makes him so much more compelling a character because he has that in his closet, so to speak, you know, or his wardrobe, or whatever the expression is. Anya's mention of it in Spy Who Loved Me, his shutdown of it so quick is
brilliant.
And acerbic. It's brilliant. And in this, in License to Kill, Dalton's catching of the I don't, you know, is just unreal. It's just unreal how good these moments are and how they make that character way much more rounded than possibly it's got any right to be. But it was right there in the source material, all this.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Right there.
It's the greatest, for me, hands down, it's the greatest performance of James Bond in a film.
License to Kill.
Hands down, for me, there has never been a better performance by an actor as James Bond than Timothy Dalton in License to Kill. Because the range of emotion that goes on throughout that film, he goes through everything. That film, I remember watching that for the first time at 11 year old.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And I remember my dad saying to me, "Oh, you don't want to watch this guy. Yeah. He was rubbish." And he was really, really dismissive of it. And I remember watching that 11-year-old straight away and said, "That's my favorite Bond film, and he's my favorite James Bond." And he's always been my favourite James Bond because that performance is mesmerising to me. I think it's unbelievable.
I got sent a proof of a new novel that's coming out in June, right? And everyone's excited about it. It's going to be amazing. It's by a Northern writer called Mike Craven, who it's going to be brilliant. He's going to smash it. But the opening scene is a bank heist and the five people on the bank heist are wearing Bond rubber masks. And it's like, right, so Craig goes in the front door and in the narrative of it, the Craig shoots the Dalton in the back of the head and says he was the worst Bond anyway. And like that was where I was like, right, that is enough. You're not getting a quote from me.
So who's wrong though, Rob? It's not the author. He's pointing out the character was wrong.
The character was wrong. Yes, thank you. Yes. But I know, but in private, the author has said to me, Dalton was the worst Bond anyway.
Oh right. Well, there you go.
Sickening.
It's all over. It's all over.
It's a myth.
It is a myth. But it is something that's repeated, and I've seen it in... And like weird things, I think I mentioned it in the book where I was reading an article where it's like all the things we don't like about Bond sort of get stuck onto Dalton. So somebody in one book article was saying, and there's that bit where he made a quiche. Well, actually, that was Roger Moore. Oh, I remember reading an interview with Mel Gibson. He was talking about it. And when he said that the Bonds have been getting shorter since Sean Connery and Dalton was short, and he's like 6'2". And this is mad. Yeah. And it's just once you get that label of unsuccessful, people just sort of stick things on, even though actually he was successful, generally speaking. Critically, it was mixed, but they always are. But again, it comes back to that box office figure of 150 odd million, which is 40 million less than Living Daylights.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, has hallmarked them. But, you know, the fans talk about it very differently, and like you guys are talking about it, which is
good. The competition was, I think Anthony Starr was saying, Batman,
yeah.
You know, Lethal Weapon 2, and they just had Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade.
It's the most stupid time to release a movie in the cinema.
Yeah, yeah.
Batman, Lethal Weapon 2, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2 was out that summer as well.
Yeah.
You had License to Kill, and then you had Star Trek V, and they both suffered, although Star Trek V is pretty rubbish, honestly. to be fair, and I like the Star Trek movies, but that one's pretty rubbish. But it's not just the release window, which they went in the middle of the biggest blockbuster summer ever. They also, the ad campaign in America was horrific. It's a dreadful campaign, and they didn't put much money behind it, so nobody knew that Bond was out. You look at the poster and you have Dalton in sort of in the gun barrel pose, he's not in the right suit, and there's this weird square with Sanchez's or the women in it, and Sanchez's face is in flame behind and it's just like, well, that's crap. The British poster was way better, but the American marketing was dreadful.
If you're enjoying Really 007, why not follow us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram? Look us up at Really 007 Pod.
I also think another thing that I really appreciated from your book was the analysis about how License to Kill changes genre.
From action to action.
Yeah. And I think that, like, with hindsight, that probably cuts out quite a bit of audience as well, especially with the 15 certificate as well.
It's really true. I mean, Bond movies have always done this, though. They've always adjusted and evolved to genre pretty much after On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Diamonds Are Forever feels like almost like a camp revisit of various bits. I'm sure the original script for Diamonds Are Forever had Goldfinger's brother in it. Even they thought, we need to go back to that. Live and Let Die is part blaxploitation film. Man with a Golden Gun is clearly, okay, Bruce Lee movies, let's get some sort of martial arts in this. You know, Spy Love Me is an interesting and really good movie, but it's kind of is You Only Live Twice, but, you know, with submarines. And of course, Moonraker came out because of Star Wars. So you watch the end of Spy Love Me, what's the next movie? Oh, For Your Eyes Only. Okay, cool. Yeah. And then Moonraker comes out. So they've always adjusted to that. But yeah, there is a visual similarity to some of the lighting and use of lens flare. And you talked about, Rob talked about the slow-mo running out the helicopters. That's much more US action movie. You don't see that sort of stuff in a Bond movie.
No.
Yeah.
Right. And of course,
the locations, and the locations and the cast as well. They were casting the same sort of actors. Now, that was because they had no money. And one of the stupid things about this is that Moonraker was made for $30 million. License to Kill was made for $30 million. 10 years of depreciation in between that.
Yeah.
So, you know, they had to cast actors from the US, and you don't get that slightly more European flavour. So there's that aspect to it. But visually, Alec Mills, the cinematographer, who was the same cinematographer on Living Daylights,
yeah.
You know, it clearly adjusted the look of the film to have a slightly, not flatter exactly, but a slightly more cooler palette.
Yeah.
Than in Living Daylights. It does give it a different look and a feel, but I still think it's very Bondian. I still think that, you know, it has great stunts. It has the setup of M and you know, Q's performance, Desmond Llewellyn, is brilliant, and his role
absolutely.
In it is so great. And they give him something to do as well, which is really nice. And that you see his character, that moment when he throws the broom into the bush after 25 years of telling Bond to look after gadgets is absolutely brilliant.
It
resonates. So I think it is a Bondian film, but I see for some people, they just thought, oh, this is a bit far. But actually, if you go back and look at Dr. No, is it a bit far?
Totally agree with you. I think the elements that we all talk about, that people talk about, that's not Bond. Well, they've all been done before, albeit separately in different points in the series, under different guises, etc. I think that's what makes License to Kill so great for me, is the fact that it's still a Bond film, but it's Bond pushed to his absolute limit, which is what you want to see out of characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you want to see them put into the deep end. And there's no bigger deep end than this for Bond. Mm. And this is why I love it so much. And why wouldn't you want a Shakespearean-trained actor to guide absolutely. Bond through those the most challenging moments?
Kerry, like in your book, I think it's really interesting that you say that a sort of criticism of License to Kill is that it's not, you know, it doesn't feel like a Bond movie. It doesn't feel like Bond. Whereas if you think about it, and this is something you point out in the book, there are elements that are lifted from the book. So, you know, obviously the most obvious example in the title of your book, from Live and Let Die. And also the portrayal of Bond and Bond, you know, smoking again and things like that is like Fleming's Bond. So in many ways, absolutely. It's more Bond than other, you know, previous or other ones since.
I think for those, and this won't be universally true. I mean, when the Dalton movies were coming out the Dalton movies were around, and the gap between 89 and 95 is when I basically read the Bond novels. So I think my love of Dalton is very tied into reading those at that age as well. And I think absolutely. And we
you'd imagine him as Bond when you were reading it.
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He looks like it, sounds like it, and he does behave it. Dalton always talked about, they don't mention this word. I think it was cut from one of them, this word acidy, which Fleming uses, which is a sort of moral sickness that Bond kind of enjoys and kind of doesn't. He's a conflicted character, and he, you know, he smokes and he drinks and he screws around partly to compensate for this moral world. But we do forget how controversial Dr. No was. People don't realise that Dr. No was a controversial movie. You know, it was condemned by the Vatican newspaper. People were horrified by the violence. When he shoots Dent, that was a real moment in the evolution of film violence in cinema. Well, it's on TV on a Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now it is, but 60 years ago.
Yeah.
Different story.
But that feels the same Bond as it does in License to Kill. It really
does. Definitely does.
I agree.
Definitely does. Things just turn nasty.
But yeah, one of the themes I picked up, of course, is that people say it's a much darker tone, and that there's this clear line between the silliness, in inverted commas, of the Roger Moore era, and the really gritty, serious, no laughs, no humour of Living Daylights, which is absolute rubbish, isn't it? It's a more, I don't know, it flows a bit more. If you just watch A View to a Kill and then License to Kill, although, you know, there's quite some dark moments in A View to a Kill.
Yeah, there is. You've got Glenn clearly Zorin. Wants to push it there, didn't he?
Yeah. And it was coming through. And I think by the time of License to Kill, it was like his ultimate vision of Bond, really.
Well, I think License to Kill is tonally consistent. I touch on this in the book, and it's something to maybe talk about more, but the 80s Bonds of For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy, and View to Kill are tonally very odd movies sometimes.
Yeah.
Because, and Glenn was clearly trying to toughen up Roger Moore. And, you know, that moment in For Your Eyes Only when he kicks Locke's car off, which is a brilliant moment, and Moore can do it. I mean, that's absolutely convincing. But then at the same time, you have sort of odd moments. In fact, actually, the opening of For Your Eyes Only is perfect. You have that really, you know, you talked about it beautifully earlier, this moment where he looks at the grave and it really means something. And then we've got Blofeld or whoever it is, and we're dropping him down. And it's a cool stunt sequence, but it's sort of like, that's a leap.
Keep your hair on.
Yeah.
I've just said goodbye to my wife, you know.
Yeah. Just processing some grief here by dropping you down a ton.
Yeah. And you're the person that killed my wife or is responsible for killing that.
For copyright reasons, we can't acknowledge that.
Yeah. Good job.
And why is Blofeld still in a neck brace after on a Majesty Secret Service? That's some bad doctor.
It's a prequel.
That is because it is ties in with my theory, Carrie, that For Your Eyes Only is the direct prequel to On a Majesty Secret Service.
It makes perfect sense.
So good.
John, I heard that on the Diamonds episode. I wasn't on that one, but I just listened to it recently, and like, your take on it makes all that period so much more palatable to me.
Yeah.
You know, like the fact that they're not in that order, they're not in release order. The films might actually be, you know.
It's pathetic, but I have to do it. I have to do it.
It's not pathetic.
Because I actually appreciate Diamonds Are Forever as a film in its own right now, as opposed to actually, because otherwise I always have this niggle in the back of my head, like thinking, yeah, but it's so unresolved, the Majesty's situation. But yeah, it's now the trilogy of Majesty's For Your Eyes Only, then License to Kill.
Perfect sense.
It's the John Glenn trilogy.
Kell trilogy.
I've not
thought about that. I mean, flipping out, I'll be lying awake later on tonight.
After watch all three, back to
that. I can't think of anything else.
That's the only way to watch that. That makes perfect. But you're right. But there is a tonal inconsistency, and I think Glenn was clearly pushing it, and Moore was against that. And Moore was less involved in A View to a Kill, and apparently he was really quite surprised when he saw all the the scenes, you know, of Zorin shooting the people in the mine and stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah.
He was not happy with that. He didn't think that worked. I think those scenes worked really well because Zorin's a real proper psychopath, and it's a great performance as well.
Oh, superb.
That's one of the things we were saying about License to Kill, is that it's got, we see the villain doing awful things, yeah. And that just, that we haven't seen an awful lot of that in the recent films. It, when you've got, you know, Zorin doing that, you've got Sanchez doing that. I'm sure we probably agreed that Bardem is probably the best. Silver's probably the best villain, main villain of the... Well, Mads Mikkelsen was excellent, but he wasn't in it enough. But when you see... we don't really see him do an awful lot. He's just very menacing and threatening, and he lights up the screen whenever he's in it. But seeing Zorin do that, and seeing Sanchez put Milton Crest in the... The money tin or whatever it is. But goodness me. I don't know. It gives it that extra... oomph. And
well, it raises the stakes, doesn't it? And Della does, and maiming Gideon, it gives a sense of real jeopardy. And this was happening in late 80s action movies, and it certainly happens in License to Kill, is that, you know, Bond really suffers, physically suffers.
Yeah.
By the end, he's dragging himself up.
Yeah.
And with a machete in his face. And
absolutely.
Apparently, Dalton really wants for his life from that explosion as well.
But, oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's really him just running from an explosion. But that looks, which is great.
Those sequences in that film, you know, if people like were to say, oh, the you know, these two films, Bond doesn't do very much. Like, some of the sequences in these two Dalton films are unbelievable. Yeah, like, peak of the entire franchise.
He's on that tanker chase. You know, he is on the back of it.
Absolutely amazing. And the drama in those sequences are unbelievable.
Yeah,
absolutely. But you have to have the personal investment for the drama to pay off.
Yeah.
And you have that because it means something. And like you say, yeah, the villains have to be scary. It's the one weakness I find with Living Daylights is, much as I love Johan Kraber as Yorgi Koskov, he's funny. Brad Whitaker feels fairly undeveloped and unthreatening. Yeah, so I think
I'd agree with that.
But Sanchez is great. Dario is you know, Oscar winner Benicio del Toro is superb in it. And you get a real sense of violence. The way that, you know, Sanchez falls apart, and there's an interesting way that he falls apart. And, you know, I mentioned in the book, and Michael Wilson's talked about Yojimbo, the Kurosawa movie from the 50s. And, you know, Fistful of Dollars, or Red Harvest, if you go back to the Raymond Chandler novels, is this character who just sort of, Dalton's Bond comes in and just sort of destroys everything from within. It's kind of Shakespearean and tragic.
Yeah, it is,
It collapses in, yeah.
What's amazing about Sanchez for me is that you've described the threat and you've seen the stuff that he does, but actually he's the most charming person in the film as well.
So
And that's amazing. Sorry. Because it keeps Dalton, they realise that Dalton's strength is not particularly the funny quips like they are in Living Daylights. So they pass the charming lines to the villain. And like, you see through this villain that actually, if you are loyal to him, he is not like Zorin. He's not going to shoot you down for no reason. He is going to reward you. He is quite a charming... Obviously, it's got the Escobar vibes about it.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a fascinating dynamic that on one sense, you've got this very, very dangerous man. And yet, on the other sense, you've got this bromance going on between... Well, he thinks there's a bromance going on between him and Bond until the very last scene, really.
And it's a real personal betrayal that Bond does them, that he feels as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's multi-layered.
It's interesting, when Dario dies, he's screaming Sanchez's name.
Yeah.
He screams for him.
Sanchez!
And it's a great meat grinder bit, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah.
It's the bloody machine off!
The influence of the books is there, and the short story, The Heidelbrand Rarity, was where Milton Crest comes from. But they also developed, and something I talk about a lot, which I think is really interesting in Dalton's Bonds, is the women. Is throughout both movies, the women grow. And very often in Bond films, it's the opposite. So Kara in Living Daylights is a shy cellist who doesn't really know what she's in. By the end, she's, you know, punching guys off her Jeep. And, she's maybe piloting a plane badly, but she's piloting a plane and she's doing all this cool stuff.
Yeah.
Pam helps all the way through. It's very clever because they split her off in the plane, so she's doing stuff and helping, and so it doesn't compromise Bond. Lupe actually grows as well. She never, you know, particularly needs rescuing, and she's working on stuff. And I think it's really good because I always get annoyed, and it happens in Tomorrow Never Dies with Wei Lin, who is brilliant right up until the point where the script needs it to be useless.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's just like, what a letdown, because she was such a good character. They don't do that in Dalton's Bond. The women are strong. And I think this is how you have to react. You don't change Bond. You change everything around him.
Yes.
So the women are, you know, you talked about Dinosaur Forever earlier. Tiffany Case starts so well in that movie. Yeah. Feisty. By the end of it, it's just like,
yeah.
Okay. On the oil in a bikini.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know just what you mean. I was reading a favorite book series of mine recently. And I can't help always equating to Bond because it's so formative to me, but I can't help it. So this book series is like a number of books long, where I've got up to a character from 15 years ago has cropped up again with the heroine from that book. And they've just got like a fishing business in the Caribbean. And I just, the thing that immediately came to my head was Bond and Carrie Lowell. You know, like, because you could imagine those two calling it a day on the business. That's it. You know, because I always felt that Dalton's Bond was quite, potentially quite monogamous.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Carrie, you mentioned this in the book. This was one of, I just, honestly, Carrie, like the amount, like lying in bed next to my wife reading this book, like, she's saying, like,
where's this going?
No, I'm bad. But, you know, like, the amount of
I didn't know.
Like,
I mean, I thought it was all right.
The joy of Dalton.
Bloody hell.
Sorry.
But, like, I'm like, you know, and I'm smiling. She can see I'm smiling while I'm reading this because I'm agreeing so much, you know, like, so, but it was, I can't, you've thrown me so much.
I've thrown you.
It's about him and Pam. Yeah.
Pam. It was that, Pam being Bond's equal, you know, like that suggestion possibly that he's been looking for his equal all this time and he's finally found her.
Well, Tracy was, wasn't she?
Yes.
Tracy, you know, is not from the same background, but, you know, she drives the car beautifully during when they're in the, the ice rink race and all that stuff, and she really helps out. So she's, again, she grows through the story. I mean, she goes from being suicidal at the beginning to, I mean, happy until she's shot, obviously. But, you know, up until that point, if we just ignore the last reel, you know, it goes really well.
Down's our photos.
So I think it's important. But, you know, Natalia does it in GoldenEye. I think GoldenEye works really well because Natalia, and it's very clever because Natalia, but given making her technical, she's successful, but not in Bond's area.
Yes.
So she can just be useful. And they have a lot of fun with that. And there's a lot of jokes about that. But I do, and it's annoying when they build a Triple X Anya in Spy Who Loved Me. Again, perfectly brilliant and competent just until the point where Bond has to rescue her. So if you put her in an evening gown, she's useless.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like, but Pam's contribution to the final act of License to Kill is pivotal.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
Pivotal in so many occasions.
Even with Wayne Newton.
Yeah.
Getting all that stuff.
Which are such great scenes as well. They're such great.
Oh, they are. Comedy. Loads of comedy in.
They say that the Dalton's Bond's not funny, but there's a lot of humour, and you're right, a lot of it's on Sanchez, but Wayne Newton as Professor Joe provides a lot of humour.
Just brilliant. So, Rob, do you think there's more chance of Dalton's Bond settling down with Pam than Kara? That's quite interesting, though.
Yeah, definitely.
Not really thought about that.
Because I thought Pom?
Pom.
Pommy, yeah.
Pam was much more of Bond's equal, I thought.
Yeah.
I thought that always Dalton's Bond had a great deal of respect for her in a professional sense. And trusted her judgment. I don't think he ever really trusted Kara's judgment. I think he was extremely romantically affectionate with her. Mm. I mean, they go on a date in the Prater. They're obviously, there's a huge deal of affection there. And I love this about Dalton's Bond is that he does have that capacity for affection that isn't just whiling away the time, you know, which, I mean, I do adore it and I'll never say anything bad against it.
5 hours like, in Rio.
Well, no, five, you know, it's five days to Alaska, you know. Five days, man. I mean, just the chafing alone would be abysmal, you know. But, like, you know, just the fact that, like, at certain points in the franchise, women have been there to kill time for Bond, and that's never been the case with Dalton's Bond. But no, I'd love to think of Pam and Dalton's Bond, like, having, like, I don't know, like a lovely little fishing business on a, you know, on a beach somewhere.
I think we could write this with it, where we could, you know, a pseudo sequel where, you know, the fishing business is running and they drag back into action one last time.
If you know, if on the beach, you know, like maybe I don't know, like Dario's son that he didn't know he had came to take out Pam, and Bond is called back. This has got everything.
I mean, without like putting it down on it, we're just going for Frank Grimes from The Simpsons now at this rate.
Yeah. You
know, his son came back to avenge Homer.
We no more relations. I don't want anybody son of anybody in any of these movies.
No more.
He's allowed
no,
children.
That's the thing. Yeah, that's the funny one. Would in that scenario, would Pam and James have had a child? I don't know. I can imagine they would actually. It's the Pam and James from the movie.
You put a lot of time into this, Rich.
Yeah, no,
really, no. I am. I'm thinking on my feet here, Kerry.
Is it really the only time he actually chooses? You see him choose and.
I think it's a rejection of Lupe. For me, is the old style Bond girl. She's very reminiscent of Domino in Thunderball. Yeah. And right at the end, you know, Bond is given the choices: do you stay with the Lupe character, will be fun and stuff, or do you throw yourself off the balcony and into the swimming pool for the one who is more like you and you know, the stronger woman and the more equal woman? And he chooses that, and I think that's a really important moment.
I agree with that. I think Lupe is very much a survivor in life. She gets with Sanchez. I don't want to go back there. She's got that for that life. She will do whatever she needs to do to get herself out of the situation. So and I think Bonnie sees that in quite a lot of senses, in like, you know, it's implied that she then goes and just chats up El Presidente. Very interested. But
I love James so much.
We'll just ignore that line. If ITV4 knows how to do things well, that's the line they'll edit out of the whole film. Never mind any of Ella being impaled
from Q, which are brilliant.
She is. Yeah. You know, I think the old fashioned Bond girl, and we move forward and we move on. And Pam's really interesting. I was reading about this again, first time in ages, that Talisa Soto, who played Lupe, was, I mean, very raw as an actress, but she tried to put a lot into the role. And you're absolutely right to talk about those sorts of, she's on the move, she's thinking about it. And there's one scene where she's reading the book. You can't see what the book is, I don't think. But they passed her some sort of thin book. She says, no, I want a fat book that's about power or something. I want people to know that Lupe is thinking, working on stuff. And there she is. She's got the house. She's got the diamond choker from the iguana on her wrist. And she might be about to marry the president at the end. She'll be fine.
Don't worry about Lupe.
I thought you hated that thing.
Don't you know? Iguanas are a girl's best friend.
To you, madame.
Cheers. Thank you for everything, James. You could stay here with me.
Excuse me. I think you and El Presidente will make a perfect couple.
And also, Pam is the first Bond girl who's come on to Bond aggressively.
You mentioned
this, don't you, Kerry?
He does.
Yeah, like
really interesting.
And I think like Bond's like, yeah.
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 Well, I think it really works well for the film because, you know, especially because I'd always thought of this, you know, it being Bond revenge mission. Stupidly, really, lazily, I thought, because his friend, you know, to take revenge because his friend's been
Well, is that too, by a shark. Yeah, it is. But then it's more because not only has that happened to his friend's wife on the day of the wedding has been murdered, and, you know, it's insinuated that she's been raped, which is just absolutely horrific. And they've kept Felix alive to suffer, you know what I mean? And so it's even more than that. But then I'd never thought of Bond seeing the similarities between Tracy dying on her wedding day. And I mean, it's poor that I didn't think of it, but, you know, Tracy dying on his wedding day and his best friend's wife dying on their wedding day.
Oh.
And, you know, just that projection. So the reason I'm saying that is that he then sets off on his mission of kind of revenge. He's not looking to hook up or anything like that. So it fits in. It fits in that Pam sort of comes onto him, absolutely. And that's not the mission. He knows what the mission is, but, you know, and
he keeps trying to get rid of her, and he keeps trying to send Q home as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. He does.
Q.
Yeah.
Gary, have you read the license, John Gardner's License to Kill?
I did years ago, and I haven't looked at that in forever.
No, the only reason is because I cannot stop laughing when I think about it. Not for any reason that, you know, is inappropriate, but because obviously it's supposed to be a continuation from the original. And in Live and Let Die, obviously Felix gets eaten by a shark, and then he gets eaten again. By a shark.
The other leg,
Poor guy just cannot get a break whatsoever. You know,
especially with sharks.
Sharks, you know?
It's like anyone an Anchorman fan?
Yes.
It's like Luke Wilson's character who keeps losing his arms.
Yeah. Oh, not again. Why? Always. Why? No,
it's I'm blessed. I haven't read the John Gardners in a long time. I did read pretty much all of them back in sort of the 90s because, you know, and books were harder to get back then, no bloody Amazon.
You know,
every time I went into a bookstop, it's like, can I find a John Gardner Bond novel in paperback to read? And but, you know, it's funny with the Gardeners. I enjoyed them at the time, and I can't remember a damn thing about most of them.
No, I know. I do know what
he drives a Saab. I can remember the Saab.
Realist?
Yeah. Okay. That's an interesting choice, John.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Anthony Stark. I played Truman Lodge in License to Kill, and you're listening to Really 007.
In your book, you mentioned the politics of the time. It was a bit more complicated because it was nearing the end of the Cold War. I think Britain wasn't as dominant in the world. You know, it was no longer this sort of flashy country.
I mean, actually, when Fleming was writing them, Britain's in decline. Britain, you know, geopolitically is in decline after the Second World War, arguably before, but certainly. And Fleming's novels are in a sense, a sort of a fantasy of British power. Is that, okay, people might not think we're that good, but behind the scenes, we've got people like James Bond, we've got the best Secret Service, we're doing these sorts of things. And that's really, you know, the in the 60s and part of that wave of British culture with the Beatles and the Bond films become part of a restatement and a reshaping of British identity. Yeah, I mean, you know, the reality is that, one, the Cold War's been happening and it's an American and Russian thing and we're involved. And the Bond films, when they do engage with the Cold War, kind of flip it and say, actually, Britain are fighting it and the Americans just turn up at the end to help us, don't they? The Berlin Wall's about to come down. Okay, they didn't know that, but it's in the air. The old ideas of who's the good guys and the bad guys are really jumbling up. So where do you go from that? And I think License to Kill is interesting because it takes Bond way out of the traditional sort of areas of a Bond film by going to, I know Isthmus City is made up, but going to sort of Latin America, other than the Killing Time in Rio sequence. It's a very different world for him to be on. And you know, I think, looking back, it was Michael Wilson who came up with Sanchez and the drugs idea, and I think that's actually pretty forward-thinking. It was, you know, when it came out, people said, oh, that drugs people don't influence politicians and presidents. So
yeah.
That's ridiculous. And of course, you look back and you think, yeah, they do. They really got that. But yeah, it's always a difficult thing with Britain as a world power. And it's going to be, you know, will do the Bond films now acknowledge Brexit? And how do you deal with all those sorts of, the fallout of all those sorts of issues? It's always difficult to orient because the world is not as simple. We don't have any easy bad guy like we used to. You know, I guess North Korea, maybe.
Carrie, do you think that the two Dalton films, because both have heavy drug politics angles, don't they? Do you think they were... that the cinema-going public weren't ready for that?
I think it's always true with the Bond film, is that half of them want the movie they watch their favourite Bond that they've written in their head that they know. But Living Daylights did better than View to a Kill.
Yes.
So they weren't bothered about that. I don't think it's the drugs angle that's the problem in terms of the box office and the readiness. I mean, we talked about the advertising and those sorts of things. I think it was more that. I think if they'd released License to Kill at Christmas with a decent advertising campaign, it would have made a fortune. And I think that another adult movie would have happened really quickly.
Why you talk about that? I mean, having read that bit in the book about, it's Bob Peake, isn't it? The poster designs. Those designs are unbelievable. Mm. They are, I mean, they're more striking than anything I've seen. I mean, in the series, they're as striking as anything in the series you are likely to see. God, I've just put here, License Revoked. What is Carrie's take? That's on my on my notes here. Like, what is your take on that? Like, is that what you think, that if this was marketed correctly without that U-turn, and put out at a different time, that perhaps License to Kill would have been much more successful?
Yeah, I think so. And those Bob Peake art and a lot of the art they did when it was called License Revoked is much better than anything that they put out later on. Stronger, you know, James Bond 007 branding as well. I don't think the name change helped, because, you know, people then, oh, they're changing the name, they must be worried, and all these sorts of things. I think License Revoked is fine. The rumour is that Americans didn't understand the word revoked, or would associate it with their driver's licences, which I don't believe. I mean, I believe that people might think that, but I don't believe that that is what Americans think. But
which title do you prefer, though? Or is it more than they swapped it? Because I do like License to Kill, the title.
I think License to Kill is fine, but there had been another movie, I think, with Denzel Washington called that.
Oh, really?
When that came out.
Oh, wow.
I think I found out what I'm going to do after this.
Yeah. Although it's spelled... I think Denzel Washington might be set in Britain, and I think maybe he's a British accent or something. I can't remember. But I've read about it and never seen it. Of course, License is spelt in the American way with an S. I think License Revoked is fine. I know John Gardner wasn't happy because it's very similar to License Renewed, and that was another pressure coming in. But I think License Revoked would have worked because it sums up the situation. Because actually, oddly, License to Kill is about a movie where he doesn't have a license to kill.
Mm.
So in a sense, it's an odd name.
We've said sort of it's not as Britain-centric, and it's... Mm. I think you've alluded to it in the book, Bond's out of his comfort zone in both films. In Living Daylights, he doesn't know who to trust. He's going, of course, against M. And then even when he's in the Russian prison, isn't he, in Afghanistan? And then he's with Cameron Shaw, he's basically relying on other people. And he's in the middle of all this other stuff that's nothing really to do with him. And then in License to Kill, he's... You know, like you say, there's no scenes of him sort of... Apart from when he's posing in License to Kill... as, you know, this sort of guy who's coming to Isthmus. It's not really the glamorous, oh, hello, Mr. Bond, nice to meet you, and, you know, get shaken, not stirred. He's really in a danger zone the whole time.
Living Daylights is, like we said before, it's a transitional film. And if you know the deleted scenes with the magic carpet and stuff, which is such a Roger Moore sort of thing.
And
actually, I think Dalton, if you look at it, it's a very slow scene, and I can see why they cut it. I think he does fine in it. It is throwing him out of the tuxedo, and Dalton wanted that. He's like, oh, I want a leather jacket. I want to be dressed down. I don't want to be dressed up all the time. The Afghanistan scenes are really interesting because not only is it an unusual location, there's this really, and some beautiful photography in the Afghanistan scene, backlit horses and stuff. It's really beautiful looking. But there's that moment where they go through the bombed out village, and the Afghans are just peeling the clothes off the dead Russian soldiers. And it's like, that's a bit serious for a Bond movie, isn't it? That's a bit full on. But absolutely, it's throwing Bond out of, you know, everybody knows who he is when he walks into the restaurant, and everybody's, you know, comfortable with him. And it's saying that he's human and vulnerable and can make mistakes, but, you know, can bring it round as well. And that creates a greater level of human drama in the movies.
There's no way that this, that Dalton's Bond exists anywhere on the same timeline as the Bond in Diamonds Are Forever of, you just killed James Bond!
Is that who it was? Yeah.
Well, it is. We're going to have to put these in a completely different order from the...
Yeah, you will.
So I'm really confused. I mean, look, the Bond franchise has a very loose attitude to continuity because I cannot imagine Dalton's Bond being in Moonraker. I would really struggle for that. I don't want to change Moonraker. I love Moonraker. But, you know, it's a very different beast. Mm. But it's an awareness that the political reality of the world is not as clear as it used to be. That the good guys and bad guys are difficult to tell apart. Yorgi Koskov starts off. You think he's a defector. It turns out he's not. He's playing everybody off against each other. And so
the first time I've heard what's actually about.
Yeah, yeah. It's a jolly complicated film. Yeah.
So yeah, it's a realization that the world has got more complicated. It's even got more bloody complicated now, probably. But there you go.
Too much to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's not go there.
No. So, Kerry, presumably, when you had the idea to do this book, was it particularly this era that you always wanted to write about?
Well, I originally researched this. So I was doing an MA in film studies at the University of East Anglia a long time ago, longer than I care to remember. And I originally did a lot of this research and wrote up a dissertation about this then. In 2018, I had a really interesting year. It's actually starting in 2017. It's like I got quite ill. And for a while, we didn't know what it was. I was originally diagnosed with anemia. And then one morning, I got up. And I went to the loo and my urine was the colour of Coca-Cola, which was an exciting moment. It was so exciting. I got my wife and said, come and look at this. She was like, I think you should go to the doctor. And anyway, after about 6 months later, which March 2018, I was diagnosed with quite a rare disease called PNH or paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, which is a very complicated term for what I've got. And I'm treated and it's all great. And the NHS, thank God, exists. And I have to have drugs every 2 weeks. You know, injected into me. And other than a bit of fatigue, I don't really notice it. But the summer after that, I was just sort of taking stock a bit and I was looking through what I was doing and I found all my old research. I was having it tidy up and I found the old dissertation. I read it and I thought, actually, this needs changing and updating, but there's something here for me to write about. And I think reflecting on it, the diagnosis just gave me a kick up the ass to do something because it's like, okay, just do it, just pump it out there. And I had no expectation that anybody would read it or do anything to it. And then, you know, 3 years later or whatever it is, I'm talking to you guys, which is absolutely fantastic. And I've spoken to other people and people have left some lovely reviews. And one guy sent me a copy to sign to send back to into Greece, which is like really bizarre.
Brilliant.
You know, really, really nice things. So, and it's actually kicked me off writing more other things as well. It's just been a great thing. But yeah, a lot of the research I did back at university, which is like it must be 20 years ago, because I already had this annoying itch that people didn't like Dalton and they were just wrong. and I just wanted to say, you know what, you're wrong and this is why you're wrong.
That's really
underneath it all. So it was a circuitous route to get to actually putting it together. But it was absolutely my reaction to people not getting Dalton, and particularly after Brosnan's movies came out and he was so big. And I think it's interesting, we now look at Brosnan a bit like we used to look at Dalton. We're not sure about Brosnan anymore, at least a lot of the community is, and we question it. I think there's a Bond life cycle. I think it happened to Roger Moore as well, is that they come out, they're successful, and then about 10 years later everybody thinks they're rubbish, and then 10 years later after that everybody starts to go, hang on a minute. Actually, and Brosnan's in the difficult middle period where we think, oh, he's useless. I think we'll come round again and like them.
He's great.
Yeah.
John Malone is champion.
I think he's better than his movies. The problem I have with Pierce is not his. He's not the problem. Mm. I think he's better than the movies he's in. And I always find that slightly disappointing.
Wow.
Was that a controversial opinion? I don't know.
No, not in any
way.
I don't think so. I do have, obviously, GoldenEye was a seminal moment almost in my life because the James Bond film was on the cinema and I, you know.
Absolutely the same.
I snuck in, as Waylon would say. and saw it and, you know, and all the, you know, everything that went with it, a song released, you know, people, your friends talking about it, whereas before I was just a Bond geek who watched them all on video. My friends didn't really necessarily do that. And then Tomorrow Never Dies, I don't know, I just judge it as a sort of a combo of a 90s action film and a Bond film sort of, and it's fairly easy viewing, I think. And then The World Is Not Enough. We did a review of it and it's gone up quite a lot in my estimations recently. I think it's far more interesting than I used to think it was. I used to think of it as like Tomorrow Never Dies Part 2, and then, you know, but I really enjoyed doing the podcast for that because it really brought loads of things sort of to the fore that I hadn't really thought of. And then Die Another Day, I mean, I know, you know, I am a vague Die Another Day defender, but very, very vague. I mean, I watched it the other week and there's so much wrong with it. But I actually think the fact that there's a structure of an action thriller that you can follow makes me like it more. Action adventure. Sorry, not makes me like it more than I really should. So I think it's the whole is better than the sum of its parts. I think that's the right way.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think so.
As in, like the whole
John's face.
If you take. Wow. As in, if you take individual bits of it, you think that's dreadful. Those lines are dreadful. That CGI is dreadful. Whereas at the end of it, I think you think, well, I know what the plot was. I know, you know, I know there was a beginning, a middle, and an end, and I know he had to do this to do that, and then.
I think Dying of the Day. I mean, I didn't like it when it came out. I've softened, like I say, my attitude softened over time to it. It's just there's just some weird, odd choices, directorial choices. Like those weird speeded up moments. It's just like, what is that doing there?
Yeah, and I know we talked about slow-mo in License to Kill before, but there's some weird... There's the speeding up and there's the slowing down. Yeah. And it's just like...
You didn't do that in The Edge, though. I mean, what a film.
I
know.
Well, I was really excited by Lee Tamahori because once War Warriors in The Edge, I thought, oh, this is going to be really interesting. Course, yeah. He's really tough director, and he did the completely opposite. If you look at movies since, Triple X The Next Level with Ice Cube, Vin Diesel, and and it's like, okay, well, I think we found the real Lee Tamahori, and it's this guy over here. Who was the other guy? Who was the guy who did The Edge? That's cool.
When you were writing the book, what sort of research did you do other than watching the Bond films?
I read everything. I mean, I've got some stuff here. I went to the University Library in Lincoln, which isn't far from me to look stuff up. I've still got all my old James Bond fan club 007 magazines, which are great. I've got a pile of them, just books and books. And then, you know, we now live in the world of the internet, which is incredible for research. So it was just checking things, updating things, different fan books, different fan magazines, and just looking through that. I'm trying to remember the history book I was looking at earlier when I was revising in case you gave me a quiz, which is because there's been some really good books. And actually, it's interesting, as there's been no Bond movies, I think there's been a real boom in people like myself writing Bond stuff. We're kind of filling the gap. I do a bit of media theory with my students, and there's a guy called Clay Shirky who talks about the rise of the prosumer, which is the distinction between the producer and the consumer has collapsed. Is we now create our own material to consume amongst each other's, and you know, we make, whether it's YouTube videos or, you know, podcasts like this, and then people are publishing books. And I think it's really cool that we sort of stepped up to fill those things in. And yeah, so I just read everything I could, went back to the novels, looked at them, and of course just watched the movies a lot. But that's okay.
I think you're right, though. Before the internet, all that, there wasn't much going back and analysing previous things. It was more looking forward to the next Bond or looking forward to the next thing. But now we've got all this opportunity to sort of chat with like-minded people. I mean, this couldn't have happened, could it? You know, if it wasn't for Zoom and all these tools we've got, just chatting and over the internet and Twitter and things.
I also think
like-minded people, isn't it?
It is. But I was thinking what Matt was saying about GoldenEye. I mean, GoldenEye was amazing. And I was taping the music video off TV to rewatch.
Yes.
It makes me laugh because somebody on Twitter shared the official guide to GoldenEye magazine, and I've still got that somewhere. And I pegged it up a while ago and looked at it, and it tells you the whole goddamn film in there.
Yeah, it does.
It tells you the plot. I mean, talk about spoilers. It's bizarre.
I only got it afterwards, thankfully.
You know, I read the novelization and all these things. I knew exactly what was going to happen. It's really, now you wouldn't stand for it, but at the time I just read everything. But you had to work quite hard to get stuff. You had to. I remember sending off to join the James Bond fan club, and I must have joined in, I don't know, 93, 94, sending off a £25 postal voucher, they were, postal check or whatever. It's, I mean, do they even exist? I don't know. And being really excited that every 2 months or whatever it was, the magazine would turn up. It was really, really good. Now it's way more accessible, and it's really good to be able to connect with people. Really the best.
Join us for part two, where Carrie discusses more of his book He Disagreed With Something That Ate Him, and we explore more of the themes from The Living Daylights and License to Kill.
Hi.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.